Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with our ongoing series, Special Investigative Report on Vaccines, A Second Opinion. Program number 9 in this ongoing series. I'm doing this program at this time because of an article that was recently sent out dealing with the CDC claiming that children who were vaccinated were more susceptible to illnesses that they had been vaccinated from by children who were not vaccinated, and therefore the children who were not vaccinated were placing other children who were at risk. And therefore suggesting any parent who did not vaccinate was making the child susceptible to illnesses. I challenge that completely. In fact, first off, just common sense. If the whole reason of vaccinating yourself for measles or mumps or anything else is to protect you from the illness when you come into contact with it, if you're then suggesting that if you get around someone who has not been vaccinated, it makes you more susceptible, then what was the point of the vaccination? Where is its protective effects? So that was just on that. But then I decided there's probably a lot of people who really are terrified at the idea that they do have an option. It is not within the purview of my program, or me individually, to suggest you vaccinate or not. My information is simply given to show you what options that you may have based upon more complete information from which you can make your reasoned and informed choice. Today, then, I want to take you on a lessons of history journey. I also want to show you what they have not reported in this article, the extent of adverse side effects from all the different vaccines. As we've seen again and again, there has been a direct relationship between vaccinations and an increased incidence of the diseases they supposedly prevent. This contradiction has prompted several researchers to conclude that vaccines are neither safe nor effective. In a 1926 British Medical Journal article by Dr. Parry, he asks why vaccine statistics reveal a higher death rate among the vaccinated. Quote, how is it that smallpox is 500% more as likely to be fatal in the vaccinated as in the unvaccinated? How is it that it is some of our best vaccinated towns, for example, Bombay and Calcutta, smallpox is rife, while in some of our worst vaccinated towns, such as Leicester, it is almost unknown? How is it that something like 80% of the cases admitted into the smallpox hospitals have been vaccinated, while only 20% have not been vaccinated? How is it that in Germany, the best vaccinated country in the world, there are more deaths in the proportion to the population than in England? For example, 28 deaths in England in 1919 per 100,000 and 770 in Germany. What is the explanation? Unquote. An article entitled Vaccination in Italy, which appeared in the New York Medical Journal in 1899, makes similar observations. Quote, Italy is one of the best vaccinated countries in the world, if not the best of all. For 20 years, our nation was vaccinated in the proportion of 98.5%. In 1987, we had 16,249 deaths from smallpox. In 1988, we had 18,000. In 1989, 13,000. Unquote. Based on these facts, the article concludes, quote, vaccination is a monstrosity, a misbegotten offspring of error and ignorance. It should have no place in either hygiene nor medicine. Believe not in vaccination. It is a worldwide delusion, an unscientific practice, a fatal superstition with consequences measured today by tears and sorrow without end. Unquote. In his book, The Vaccination Superstition, Dr. Hodges concludes the following. Quote, after careful consideration of the history of vaccination, gleaned from an impartial and comprehensive study of vital statistics and pertinent data from every reliable source, and after an experience derived from having vaccinated 3,000 subjects, I am firmly convinced that vaccination cannot be shown to have any logical relation to the dimension of cases of smallpox. Vaccination does not protect. It actually renders its subjects more susceptible by depressing vital power and diminishing natural resistance. Millions of people have died of smallpox, which they contracted after being vaccinated. Unquote. In 1937, Dr. William Howard Hay addressed the Medical Freedom Society. The subject was the Lemke Bill to abolish compulsory vaccination in the United States. Hay stated, "I have thought many times of all the insane things we have advocated in medicine. That is one of the most insane, to insist on the vaccination of children or anyone else for the prevention of smallpox, when, as a matter of fact, we are not able to prove that vaccination saved one man from smallpox. I know of one epidemic of smallpox comprising 900 in some cases, in which 95% of the infected had been vaccinated, and most of them recently. It is now 30 years since I have been confining myself to the treatment of chronic disease. I have run across so many histories of children who have never been sick a day until they were vaccinated, and who have never been well since." Regarding the tetanus vaccine, Dr. Murray states the following in the Medical Journal of Australia, March 19, 1959. "I had an occasion a few years ago to review a great bulk of literature in the English language and some selected German translations on the subject. No evidence was found by me to suggest that tetanus anti-serum had any value as a prophylactic agent against the development of tetanus following accidental trauma to humans. If any person or manufacturers of this dangerous material have evidence to the contrary, the time is ripe to present the evidence for evaluation. In the absence of such evidence, tetanus antitoxins should be classed as both dangerous and useless, and its continued manufacture and prescribing as a pharmaceutical benefit for the purpose of prophylaxis against tetanus in humans a waste of public money. Today, despite its problematic history, vaccine research continues steadily. In fact, the Clinton administration has issued a national call to rush an AIDS vaccine to the market within 10 years. In Arthur Barbarlow Fisher's view, this is good politics but bad science. And Bush, by the way, will be continuing in the same line. Quote, HIV takes a different route in everyone's body, so to try to suggest that we're going to be able to produce a generic vaccine to protect everyone when that virus is a unique virus that acts differently in each person's body is, I think, an illusion. Clinton calling on industry and government scientists to rush an AIDS vaccine to market before we know the true origin of AIDS, before we understand much more about that virus, is really very dangerous, unquote. Alan Phillips summarizes the historical perspective of the problem. He says, "Vaccination history is riddled with documented instances of deceit designed to portray vaccines as mighty disease conquerors, when in fact, many times it actually delayed and even reversed disease declines. The United Kingdom's Department of Health admitted that vaccination status determined the diagnosis of subsequent diseases. Those found in vaccinated patients received alternate diagnosis. Hospital records and death certificates were falsified. Today, many doctors are still reluctant to diagnose diseases in vaccinated children, and so the myth about vaccine success continues." Let's talk now for a moment about provocation disease. And by the way, the reason I gave you some of these historic statements is to show you that the debate around the efficacy and the safety of vaccines is not new. It dates back over 100 years. And some of the leading clinicians and scientists, publishing in peer-reviewed journals at their time, challenged the view that vaccines were safe by clearly showing that where you had the highest rate of vaccine in the world, in Germany, you also had the highest rate of diseases that were supposed to be vaccinated against. One of the most hazardous and insidious effects of vaccination lies in its potential to induce other forms of disease, a phenomenon known as provocation disease. The mechanisms that cause this to happen are unclear, although many scientists believe that latent viruses, that is, viruses already existing within a person, may be stimulated by vaccinations, and that this may be enough to activate a particular illness. Vaccination, therefore, may not be the sole cause, but rather the final trigger for an illness. In his book, Vaccination and Immunization, Dangers, Delusions, and Alternatives, Leon Chatal states that there is no way of knowing when such latent or incubating situations may be operating, and therefore no way of knowing when a vaccine may produce this sort of provocation. He goes on to warn that provocation of a latent virus is a potentially dangerous possibility with every vaccination procedure. Many diseases thought to be caused, at least partially, by vaccinations do not surface until years later, by which time it's difficult to prove a connection. However, links can sometimes be made. A 1974 issue of Modern Medicine of Australia contains an article entitled Severe Complication of Measles Vaccination that states, quote, subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, a rare complication of measles which causes progressive crippling infection of the central nervous system, has been reported to occur months or years after vaccination with live virus or measles vaccine. Subacute sclerosing panencephalitis occurred in one child 2 years after vaccination with live measles virus and another 8.5 years later. Both exhibited delayed hypersensitive reactions to killed measles virus, unquote. Now, what that means, just lay language, is that the entire mechanism for determining whether or not a vaccine has caused a problem is too short. Therefore, anyone who has a vaccine reaction a few weeks after the vaccine will, in all likelihood, never have it reported as an adverse reaction to the vaccine. And clearly, if you have a delayed reaction of a year later, which is very probable, there'll be no connection at all made to the vaccine as being the cause. So we are not just underreporting, we are grossly underreporting because we have made too short a time span. And also we haven't looked at all the potential diseases. If we don't want to believe that vaccine could cause autism, then we will never look at autism as caused by vaccine. We will not examine it. We won't research it. We'll have people giving their opinion. Their opinion is worth nothing. Facts count. Examine the facts, stay neutral until you have those facts, then make the best determination you can. That's not being done with vaccines. Cynthia Coiner sees a parallel between vaccines and addictions. She says, when a person is first exposed to alcohol, his tolerance is very low and the effects are felt much sooner. After a period of time, a person can handle their liquor. Nicotine displays a similar response. The first cigarette often makes a person sick. Watery eyes, nausea, coughing are not uncommon. After a period of time, this person smokes one or two packs a day without many obvious outward effects. Are these addicted people healthier than those who did not use drugs, or alcohol, or cigarettes? Are these people considered immune to drugs, alcohol, and cigarettes? Of course not. We say that these people can tolerate large amounts of poison. And if they don't cut down or quit, they can expect heart attacks, high blood pressure, and cancer. These people no longer get sick from the first cigarette or drink, but they are not healthier. They are more subject to the chronic, less curable, and more devastating diseases. Immunity is when the body resists infection. Tolerance is when the body adapts to repeated exposures to toxins. It is clear that vaccines are forcing the body to adapt, unquote. In other words, vaccines can suppress symptoms, causing worse diseases later on. According to Aline James, diseases associated with vaccinations are degenerative and autoimmune diseases, she says. They include cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, systemic lupus, erythematosus, Parkinson's, AIDS, and allergies. They are all nervous system disorders, such as learning disabilities, hyperactivity, meningitis, mental retardation, and paralysis. These have been documented in various medical studies, unquote. Vera Schreibner also put forth an interesting, if frightening, theory on just how destructive the disguised effects of vaccines may be on the body over time. She says, normal portals of entry for infectious agents, the mouth, the nose, are instrumental in the natural immunological process. Vaccines being injected into the bloodstream bypass these normal passages. Immunologists repeatedly warn that unless vaccination exactly emulates the natural immunity process, lifelong immunity cannot and will not be achieved. Moreover, introducing vaccines into the circulation gives them direct access to the major immune organs and tissues without any obvious way of getting them out. Various elements of vaccines can stay in the body for long periods of time, some of them permanently, often by incorporating themselves into the genetic material of the host cells. This provokes constant effort to expel these foreign substances, leading to a systemic weakening of the immune system. Constant antigenic stimulation of the immune system leads to cancer and leukemia and a host of other autoimmune diseases. Instead of providing protection against acute infectious diseases, vaccination drives the disease deeper into the body and leads to chronic infestation by pathogenic agents. Subacute sclerosing panencephalitis is one of the many examples of this slow process. Warts, herpes, shingles are other examples. Unquote. A child receives up to 33 different vaccinations by the time he or she enters kindergarten. According to Dr. Murphy, the child's bloodstream and developing immune organs are bombarded with billions of vaccine antigens and other toxic preparations from five or more different vaccines. Just as insidious effect of industrial solvents does not quickly disappear from our water and land, it appears that similar effect may be produced in our bodies by vaccines. Unquote. Some of the relationships between vaccines and the specific conditions they provoke are discussed now. And mind you, these are never presented when someone is trying to defend the vaccine. And also, as an investigative reporter, as well as a scientist, I don't trust everything I read because so much of it is self-serving. And today, you don't know whose interest and whose agenda is really behind a particular article, whether it's on the internet or in a prestigious medical journal or in a newspaper column. So I always examine the information and then try to go over the same original material that they did. And all the time, I find that I would have come up with totally different summations or conclusions looking at the same identical material. For example, last year and the year before, there was a major attack against soy in the United States. The people who were doing the attack were on almost every radio and television show. Now, they had a small book out from a small publisher. Being a best-selling author of more health books than anyone in American history, and doing thousands and thousands of media appearances in my career, I know what it's like to go into a city and do media, and I can tell you, with the best PR firm you could hire, you could not expect to get more than maybe five or six shows. These people were blanketing every single media in a city. And obviously they had not done their homework because they wanted to get on my show. And I looked at not just the people, but who were the people promoting them. And it was the meat industry, and it was the dairy industry, through their various so-called consumer groups. So they had tried to remove themselves directly. The dairy industry gives money to a foundation. The foundation gives it to trade organizations. Trade organizations gives it to PR firms and so-called consumer groups. So it looks like a consumer group is doing something for the consumer, but it's not. It's doing something to protect the interest of the industry. But people are more sophisticated today. They're less likely to trust what you say if you say, I'm all here on behalf of the meat industry, and I want to tell you why not to eat soy. Clearly, there are limitations with soy, but not if you use it reasonably. It has very therapeutic effects, and those are in thousands of scientific articles. But how many people did their homework? How many people stopped using soy after they heard these people who are very articulate, but completely unscientific? And one of them was a dietitian, registered dietitian. That should have told people a lot, but it didn't. So even when we could see beyond the story, we frequently don't want to. And that is obviously one of the problems we've had with vaccines. So when someone shows me an article, oh, Gary, look here, they're showing that, you know, parents who did not vaccinate their children, and I say, look at who did it. Who brought this out? Was it any manufacturer of vaccines through their association? The answer is yes. Follow the money trail, or follow the power trail, or follow the interest, and you'll see where it takes you. Here's what you should know about vaccines. Let's start with allergies. Dr. Harrison Coulter says, and this is about vaccines and allergies and how they're connected. He says, what does allergy mean? It means that your body is ready to react very, very quickly when exposed to a second time to a substance to which it's allergic. If you're allergic to ragweed, one little bit of ragweed will start you sneezing. Now, if you vaccinate a person against pertussis or some other bacillus, you're making that person allergic to that bacillus. That's what being vaccinated actually means. It means you are allergic to that bacillus in the sense that your body will react very, very rapidly if exposed to that bacillus a second time. Coulter goes on to explain that vaccines can cause children to become allergic to other substances as well by raising their level of sensitivity. Since allergy is not very narrowly focused, it means that the child will become allergic to a lot of other things in addition to the particular bacillus that the child was vaccinated against. The more you vaccinate children, the more you increase their allergic state. Vaccines play the role of hypersensitizing the individual, generally speaking, so that he or she becomes more allergic to such common foods as milk or peanut butter or wheat, which are highly allergenic substances to large numbers of the population. H.H. Merritt, in his textbook of neurology, explains that, quote, sensitized is the term technically used for allergic reaction. The greater reactivity of today's children to vaccinations and to ordinary childhood diseases expressed as a tendency to encephalitis is due to the emergence of an allergic dimension that had not been there before, unquote. But why, asks Merritt, are children today more allergic than they used to be? The question is that, quote, quite probably the level of allergic sensitizing of the American population is being steadily enhanced by the vaccination programs which commenced in the beginning of the century. Prior to 1900, encephalitis from childhood diseases was an almost negligible danger. After 1920, it was encountered more and more frequently, and today the threat of encephalitis from whooping cough or measles is the main justification for vaccination programs, unquote. Thus, Merritt concludes, the medical profession is in the curious position of urging vigorous measures against a health threat created largely by itself, unquote. And again, that's from Dr. H.H. Merritt's textbook's Neurology, 6th edition. Now let's look at sudden infant death, crib death, or SIDS. Sadly, many studies have shown vaccination to be a cause of sudden infant death syndrome. This is what Phillips reports. One study found the peak incidence of sudden infant death syndrome occurred at ages 2 and 4 months in the U.S., precisely when the first two routine immunizations are given, while another found a clear pattern of correlation extending 3 weeks after immunization. Another study found that 3,000 children die within 4 days of vaccination each year in the United States. Now, here's what's amazing, and this shows you that you've got to be more diligent than the authors of the studies. That same study that I just quoted, where they found 3,000 children die within 4 days of vaccination, also, amazingly, the authors reported no sudden infant death vaccine relationship. While yet another, and of course there's a relationship. It's just that their belief system had said there is no relationship, even if the statistics show it. Let me put it a little different way. I had a physician call me after one of my shows one evening on WMCA radio. And this physician said that he wanted to speak with me. He came over to the studio and we sat with him. And he works at a very famous New York hospital, and he is one of the directors of a department in that hospital. And he said there was just something that I said that night when he was listening to the show that it's normally on because one of his assistants listens. And it first outraged him, then it got him thinking, and then something seemed to break through. I was talking about a woman whose sister was on chemotherapy, and they were using one after another chemotherapy, but it wasn't working. And instead of stopping the chemotherapy and helping her immune system get back its strength, they continued on because the protocol had to be followed because the person was in a study. So the conclusion was that the protocol became more important than the patient. And if the patient died, never was it the protocol that caused the death. It was, well, she had cancer. She died because of cancer. And a nurse had called in who corroborated that she has, on hundreds of occasions, seen physicians using protocols where the patient got worse. The nurses brought it to their attention. The doctor couldn't stop the protocol because it was a drug company-sponsored research program. But never did they attribute the getting worse to the protocol. It was always the patient was sick anyhow. So the doctor was thinking about this, and it got him angry that we would suddenly be challenging doctors with a level of incompetence and negligence of caring more about the protocol than the patient. But then when he thought about it, he began to realize that, yes, and as he sat across from me, he said, you know, I never thought I'd come to admit that this is correct. He says, all the time we have patients who may be getting worse, and their personal physician will say, you got to change the protocol. And we say, well, we can't. They're on in a study group. So if the drug didn't help them, and if the drug's hurting them, there's nothing we can do about it. And by the way, this is not rare. This is all too common. So a doctor reporting that, yes, you have a lot of people dying within 4 days after getting babies getting their immunization, that is statistically factual. But when they don't draw the proper conclusions, like having an intellect without a context, if their belief is that the vaccine couldn't be causing the death, then they will not then go one step further and make that connection. And this happens all the time. Vera Schreibner is a retired research scientist with a doctorate in natural sciences, whose career includes the publication of 3 books, 90 articles, and scientific peer-reviewed journals. And Schreibner, who has spent most of her career researching the connection between vaccination and crib death, talks about the genesis of her work. She says, I was brought up and educated to believe that vaccines were good. Indeed, some 40 years ago, I had my children vaccinated. With my first child, we did not even link her chronic ill health with constant ear infections to the vaccine she was given. 5 years later, with the second child, we did. But even that didn't make me think that there was something wrong with the vaccine. It took research into the baby's breathing. In 1985, I met my late husband, a medical engineer, specializing in patient monitoring systems. We only knew each other for an hour when I asked him what he was doing for a living, and I asked him, I don't know why, whether he would develop a breathing monitor for babies. He said yes. It took exactly a year and a day for the first monitor to be developed, which we called the cot watch, like crib watch. During that time in 1986, crib death researchers thought that babies were dying of this mysterious affliction because there was something wrong with the breathing controls in their brain. That's why they concentrated on breathing. Lots of parents opted for monitoring systems. They'd monitor the breathing of their babies in an effort to stop them from dying of sudden infant death. We stayed in touch with all the parents and collected feedback on alarm situations because when they had an alarm on a monitor, it indicates increased risk level in breathing. And we literally stumbled over vaccinations because all babies had alarms after vaccination. Of course, they had alarms after a host of other stressful events as well, but all of them had alarms after vaccinations. When we were just truthfully telling these researchers in crib death management centers that babies have alarms after vaccination, they looked at us strangely. Some of them looked at us with hatred, and we didn't even know why. I mean, we were telling them the truth. Of course, they knew about the controversy around vaccination. We didn't. But we continued in our research. Indeed, we financed it ourselves. My late husband developed a computerized breathing monitor which gave a computer printout for a baby's breathing. And we could monitor for weeks and weeks on in because our monitor is a non-touch medical technology where the sensors go under the mattress. We started showing these researchers computer printouts of baby's breathing, and we also recorded very characteristic dynamics of critical days. In other words, when the babies had their vaccine injections, then the stress level followed an up and down pattern of critical days. There was a two-day maximum, then the stress level went down. There was an increase in the stress between 5 and 7 days, then the stress level went down. And there was an increase towards the 6th day. So it was approximately a 16-day crisis with a maximum on day 4 in between. When you have a pattern like this, you know that you are talking about evidence of a causal link. Unquote. Schreibner speaks of hundreds of babies who died in Tennessee between 1976 and 1978, shortly after the triple antigen DPT injection. She says, when we simply assess these Tennessee deaths from the day-by-day interval from the injection to death, we saw the same dynamics of the distribution of deaths along the same critical days as we recorded in breathing of babies after vaccination. I was invited to present this data to the second pro-immunization conference in 1991. An abstract of my presentation is published in the proceedings of that conference, so they were interested to see what we were doing. But they were very reluctant to disclose that they knew about the link between vaccines and sudden death. They made me think, well, do you know all about this? Is it all published? I started going to medical libraries, and to my absolute astonishment, I collected thousands of pages of medical papers that talk about the dangers and ineffectiveness of vaccinations. Unquote. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you on board. Continuing with a special in-depth investigative report, Vaccines, a Second Opinion, number 9 in the series. Ted Koren points out that not all countries have ignored Schreiber's research, like DPT to crib deaths. He says, Australia stopped making vaccinations mandatory. Shortly after that occurred, 50% of families opted not to go with the vaccination program. As a result, crib deaths dropped by 50%. This also happened in Japan. In 1975, Japan created a law to prevent vaccinating children under 2. Shortly afterwards, crib deaths and infantile convulsions virtually disappeared from that country. A few years later, parents were once again given the option to vaccinate children under the age of 2. This was probably due to medical lobbying efforts. Since that time, crib death rates have quadrupled. Again, when the parents were told that they could vaccinate children under 2, crib deaths quadrupled. This information is reported in the 1988 Pediatrics Supplement, page 973. Koren goes on. Harris Coulter and Barbara Lowe Fisher note that the terms SIDS and crib death were invented to hide the fact that most of the infants die after the vaccination. They didn't want to call the condition vaccine death and clue the public into the problem, nor did they want to face the possibility of malpractice suits. But the truth of the matter is that the majority of crib deaths occur immediately after DPT shots. Doctors do not want the risk of being sued for malpractice. Therefore, they always write crib death or sudden infant death syndrome on the death certificate, even though the words vaccine death are equally appropriate. Unquote. Koren reveals how he became interested in the topic. He says, I got interested in the subject of crib death before I knew anything about vaccinations. In 1974, Abraham Tovin, a Harvard University pathologist, did autopsies on babies that died of crib death. He found that many of them had blood in the spinal cord, which he said was due to the fact that their necks were wrenched and twisted at birth. As a chiropractor, I took that to mean that infants and children should have healthy spines maintained and that delivery should be gentle, but the spinal trauma was just one part of the overall trauma that creates crib death. Vaccines play a role in that they create an encephalitis around the brain. This damages the meninges and affects the nerve coming out of the neck that affects breathing. It seems that when the baby's head is twisted or turned, this nerve is additionally irritated. This is probably the reason for the old folk belief that you put the baby on the back, not on the stomach. Putting a baby on its stomach twists its head to the side and actually increases stress on the spine and on the nerve that controls breathing. Not long ago, a research study came out which got a lot of press. It said that babies should not be placed on their stomachs because it is associated with an increase in crib death. There is incredible denial in this area. If you look at the fact that about 10,000 babies a year are dying of crib death, you could say, is this really iatrogenic disease, physician-induced death, that is being pawned off as some mysterious disease? Another compelling connection between inoculation and an increased infant death rate was made by Dr. Archie Kalikourinis, who worked with Australian Aboriginal people in 1960 through 70. Kalikourinis found a direct correlation between a higher infant death rate and the expanded immunization program and postulated that malnutrition in infants created a weakened immune system and that vaccine injections only worsened the situation. In a report in 1984, he explains how he came to his conclusion. He says, "My original introduction to the problem of vaccination was in the field of Aboriginal health. At the time, we had one of the highest infant mortality rates in the world, higher than in rural India. In some Aboriginal colonies, every second baby was doomed to die in infancy. But the medical authorities didn't seem to have an answer for this. On the invitation of then Minister of the Interior, I went to the Northern Territory to investigate and found that the infant death rate had doubled in 1 year and looked as if it was going to double again. I couldn't explain it. Things hadn't changed. The seasons hadn't changed. Everything seemed to be basically the same. I went to America to discuss the problem with their colleagues, but no one seemed to have an explanation. Back in Australia, I sifted through the various factors which I knew could make a child sick. One factor that under certain circumstances, a routine immunization can do harm. I remember that the minister had said to me, among other things that we have done, we have stepped up the immunization campaign. I said to myself, Eureka, that's it, that's what happened. The next day, I caught a plane back to the Northern Territory. But in Alice Springs, it was just a waste of time. My colleagues didn't want to hear about my ideas. Yet I saw doctors and health on foot and in Land Rovers and forcibly taking the babies and vaccinating them against their mother's will. Many of these mothers, when they saw the health team coming, would grab their babies and flee into the shrub, mainly because they could count. They knew what happened every time the doctors came around with their needles. But the doctors forgot to note the children that died after routine immunization. They put it down as gastroenteritis or pneumonia and made no association whatsoever with immunization. Half the deaths they never heard about because the babies were buried in the scrub anyway. Also, their methods of keeping statistics were not good. The reception I got was extremely hostile, but in a typical Kalikourinis style, when I got a hostile reception, I took it further. The more I looked into it, the more horrified I became. I realized that a great deal of harm was being done, not just in Australia, but throughout the world by faulty immunization campaigns. In his book, Every Second Child, Dr. Kalikourinis adds, if some babies and the infant survived, they would have lined up again within a month for another immunization. If some managed to survive even this, they would have lined up again. Then there would have been booster shots, shots for measles, shots for polio, even TB. Little wonder they died. The wonder is that any of them survived. The excitement of this realization is difficult to describe. On the one hand, I was enthralled by the simplicity of all, the beautiful way by which the pattern fitted everything I was doing. On the other hand, I almost shook in horror at the thought of what had been and is still going on. We were actually killing infants through our lack of understanding. Unquote. One of every 500 U.S. births ends in death from sudden infant death syndrome, according to the FDA's own statistics. This equates to 7,000 babies a year. And despite the general reluctance of doctors and government officials to admit the possible link between such figures in vaccines. Some vaccine manufacturers, including Wythe Laboratories and Connaught's, both makers of DPT vaccine, do actually address the connection in their package inserts. While such manufacturers are reluctant to point to a casual or causal relationship for obvious reasons, other researchers have produced results supporting exactly this. Scribner summarizes examples of such worth. She said, quote, Dr. William Torch presented a paper at the 34th annual meeting of the American Academy of Neurology referring to the Tennessee deaths and to over 200 randomly reported sudden infant death syndrome cases. In his published abstracts, Torch wrote that preliminary data from the first 70 cases studied showed that two-thirds had been immunized prior to death. On the average, DPT 1, 2, and 3 were administered 2, 4, and 6 months of age. In the DPT sudden infant death group, 6.5% died within 12 hours of injection, 13% died within 24 hours, and 26% died within 3 days. And there was a significant clustering of deaths within the first 2 to 3 weeks of DPT injections. He also wrote that death frequencies peaked at 2 months of age in the non-DPT group and had a biophasic peak occurring at 2 and 4 months in the DPT group. Cot deaths occurred maximally in the autumn-winter season in the non-DPT group, but were non-seasonal in the DPT group. Deaths occurred mostly in sleep, in healthy, allergy-free infants after a brief period of irritability, crying, lethargy, upper respiratory tract symptoms, and sleep disturbance. Unquote. His conclusion, quite correctly, was that, quote, DPT vaccination may be a generally unrecognized major cause of sudden infant and early childhood death, and that the risks of immunization may outweigh its potential benefits. A need for reevaluation and possible modification of current vaccination procedure is indicated by this study. Unquote. Dr. Barif and associates investigated 145 sudden infant death victims who died in Los Angeles County between January 1979 and August 1980. 53 of these babies had received a DPT immunization, 27 within 28 days of death. 6 deaths occurred within 24 hours and 17 occurred within 1 week. These sudden infant deaths were, quote, significantly more than expected, where there were no association between DPT immunization and sudden infant death. Now let's look at diabetes. According to one recent report, the rate of diabetes among Americans has increased 200% since 1940, 300% in the last 15 years. Dr. Calder suspects childhood vaccinations are at least partially responsible. He points to the evidence relating DPT, hepatitis B, MMR, which is measles, mumps, rubella, vaccines to the development of juvenile diabetes. Now, I'll quote them. In October 1997, the issue of Infectious Disease in Clinical Practice, Dr. Bartholomew Clayson presented impressive epidemiological data showing that there was a 62% increase in the incidence of juvenile diabetes in Finland after the MMR vaccines were introduced in the 1980s. Clayson also showed that there was a 60% increase in juvenile diabetes in New Zealand after mass vaccination of children with the hepatitis B vaccine, and Clayson himself has used in the lab DPT vaccine to induce diabetes. Quote, the biological mechanism that Dr. Clayson thinks is at work here is that some babies already have a subclinical inflammation of insulin-secreting cells, and this is due to their exposure to diabetes-inducing viruses that are carried by the mother. When babies with this subclinical inflammation are injected with vaccines, the existing inflammation is made worse by the release of the interferon. This causes an autoimmune state, which in turn leads to immune-mediated type 1 diabetes later in children. So this is basically an immune-mediated condition in predisposed babies. Unquote. And, of course, we have so many other conditions that have been reported, including with the fact that the CDC did not properly warn people that there was an infection within the contaminated SV40 viruses, and that they knowingly gave millions of Americans poliovirus that was infected with the SV40 virus. And then we wondered, gee whiz, why weren't we told? And they then came out later and said, because we did not want to create any form of mass hysteria, even though we knew that there would be people developing rare and severe forms of cancer and other autoimmune diseases. But did they try to reach those people and tell them? The answer was no, they did not. So there was absolutely no effort to let people know. So if you, who may be cynical, will say, well, look, I mean, if there was any connection at all between sudden infant death syndrome and immunization, we would have known. I can give you many instances where they have had equally disastrous results giving different things, and they did not tell people. They withheld it. Look now, for instance, at all the people who've had problems with Gulf War syndrome. They're fully aware of the consequences of the vaccines, the anthrax vaccine, the botulism vaccine, the contaminants that went into those people's bodies. I interviewed so many soldiers that never went over to the Gulf, but they'd get their inoculation, and they came down with Gulf War syndrome. Now, how can you say it's post-traumatic stress syndrome when there was nowhere where there was any stress? And it's infectious. So all around us, the very agencies that are asking us to believe them are the very agencies that have caused numerous problems in public health and denied their responsibility for decades. What about immunosuppression and autoimmune disease? That also has to be considered. As we've already seen, the body needs to experience a full inflammatory response to create immunity, and vaccines do not allow this to happen. Instead, a chronic condition is created that can set the stage for autoimmune disease. In their book, Vaccination and Immune Malfunction, Drs. Buttram and Hoffman warn, quote, the probability of widespread and unrecognized vaccine-induced immune system malfunction and the need for scientific investigation of these effects. They discuss the fact that since vaccines' effects are often delayed and masked, their true nature is seldom recognized. This book gives a partial list of vaccine-related diseases and immunological disorders, and I thought it was very important, like the live viruses, they say. The primary antigenic material vaccines are capable of surviving or remaining latent in the host cells for years without provoking acute disease. They attach their own genetic material to an extra particle or episome to the chromosome of the host cell and replicate along with it. This allows the host cell to continue its own normal functions for most part, but imposes on it additional instructions for the synthesis of viral proteins. This presence of antigenic material in the host cell cannot fail to provoke autoimmune phenomena such as herpes, shingles, warts, tumors, both benign and malignant, disease the central nervous system, and all living organisms, including bacteria and viruses, contain genetic material, which is DNA and RNA. In fact, live viruses themselves are genetic messengers. Live bacteria and viruses can transfer their genetic information through animal cells, including human cells, which are taken up by other cells in the body. Now, although the body generally will not make antibodies against its own tissue, it appears that slight modifications of the antigenic character of tissue will cause it to appear foreign to the immune system, and thus a fair target for antibody production. Every child is born with a finite ability to combat disease, and this is his total immunity. Once a child experiences a particular disease, permanent immunity is extremely efficient, using probably 3-7% of the total immune capacity of the individual. In the case of routine childhood vaccination, it is likely that as much as 70% of the total immunity capacity becomes committed. Now, these findings could indicate that a child's immunological reserves are substantially reduced due to standard vaccines. Far from producing a genuine immunity, a vaccine may actually interfere with or suppress the immune response as a whole, in much the same way that radiation, chemotherapy, and corticosteroids and other anti-inflammatory drugs do. Although the body will not make antibodies against its own tissues directly, viruses become part of the genetic makeup, may cause cells to appear foreign to the immune system, making them a fair target for antibody production. And because the antibodies cannot rid the body of the virus completely, the virus eventually succeeds in attaining a state of latency within the cell. The circulating antibody will thereafter keep the virus within the cell, preventing any acute inflammatory response, and antibodies then begin to be produced in large quantities against the cells themselves. Under proper conditions, these latent proviruses can become activated and cause a wide variety of diseases: Parkinson's, lupus, multiple sclerosis, arthritis, even new diseases that we've never seen before. Now, let me put it in a little different way for you, and I'll bring it into my own clinical experience. Someone comes to see me. This is a female who is 35 years of age, who has been in a monogamous relationship for 12 years, has had no drugs or alcohol, in fact, listens to my radio program, and has even been a member of my health support groups. But there's a problem. The problem is that there's an ongoing local infection that doesn't heal. And because this local infection has not healed, there is case after case after case of antibiotics. But the person has been told, you've got to take the antibiotics or you could end up having this infection spread. Out of fear, the person takes the doctor's advice and goes on antibiotics and stays on antibiotics pretty much for almost 2 years. Still, the infection is there. But because the person was also taking some vitamins and having some juices and trying to be somewhat conscious about the diet, felt that maybe all that was keeping the negative effects of the antibiotics at bay. But now the person had just a routine blood check and found, lo and behold, a whole host of viruses that they were unaware that they had. And it freaked them. How did I get these? The doctor had no explanation. So that's when I sat down with this person and I explained to them. What was your life like when you were a teenager? Did the things teenagers do? And what about when you were in college? Well, they did some drugs in college and after college and drinking, yeah, and some smoking, yeah, and eating the meat, yeah, and the sugar, yeah, and sexually promiscuous, yeah. But I haven't done any of that in 12 years. And then I explained that whatever we have done early in our life stays with us. But it stays with us almost as if it's an invisible guest. And it stays not quite dormant, but it's such a low threshold of activity that it uses up a lot of our immune system. Each day, because you have some viral or bacterial presence, the body has to produce more immune modulators. And let's say if you really pay attention to your diet and you don't cheat and you don't get overstressed and you really take a lot of chlorophyll and everything, you can not only keep this in check, but you can continue to get healthier. But very, very few people ever do anything unless there's a crisis. You've heard the program, you've heard the people, you've heard people say they started on a healthy program only after they were forced to, when they had no choice. The doctor diagnosed heart disease, they were terribly stressed, then they did something. But what if the doctor hadn't said, your blood pressure is going to kill you, you've got to take it easy? Would they have taken it easy? Probably not. So you can have viruses that could have come from a vaccine. It could have come from someone else who had been vaccinated, and now you're picking up some of their cells. We don't appreciate how easy it is to transmit in body fluids, debris, viral, bacterial. Hey, look, you can just talk on a telephone and you've left some virus and bacteria particles on that telephone someone else could pick up when they talk into that same phone. We don't practice proper hygiene. Even when I have had house guests who should know better and instruct them on proper hygiene, they forget about every other second. So now you've got all kinds of viruses, all kinds of genetic damage that was done when you were younger and not realizing the consequences. And what happens is now you lose a job. Now you're in a crisis in your relationship. Now something's happening that you don't like, and you throw the body into an acute crisis. And when you're in that acute crisis, what was dormant or almost dormant becomes active. And now you get sick. That's what we're not telling people about vaccines. And now every year we're asked to take more and more and more and more. And it's only going to get more. Hope this gives you some additional insights. This series will continue. I'm not at the end of the show, but I wanted to let you know that if you wanted to order a tape of today's show, tape 11 in AIDS a Second Opinion, Vaccines a Second Opinion, call 888-317-2346. Program number 2666, 888-317-2346, program number 2666, and it's vaccines number 9. I want to take just 2 minutes, a minute and a half left here, to share the following thought. I've spent too much time at this station, and I've seen too many conflicts to allow myself to be pulled arbitrarily or capriciously or through someone else's agenda into any of the station's conflicts. I believe that the station needs a great deal of support. It's under siege almost all the time. I have issues that I have taken up with the Pacifica board. And when I saw that the current interim general manager was under attack and being criticized and condemned and thrown on the same bonfire along with Pacifica board, that puzzled me. Instead of believing in the mob, taking sides, I reviewed the facts, did my homework, did a series of interviews, and it's my conclusion that I can find no evidence. I repeat, I can find no evidence after determined, independent, unbiased research to conclude that the interim general manager is in any way complicit with any of the long-term or predetermined Pacifica board's plans for Pacifica or BAI or any other station. And therefore, she's wrongly and possibly prejudicially condemned and should not be. I would hope that in the purpose of unifying the station and its all the producers and all the people who want to see the station survive and its listeners, that we set aside our individual biases and individual feelings, even set aside that there is a separate issue. Deal with Pacifica's board, yes, but be very careful about being drawn into personal, let's say, politics by who you agree or disagree with on the air and condemning this woman, who my research shows does not deserve the statements I have seen or heard made against her. And I will leave it at that and hope that you will do more homework on your own. Have a good day, everyone.